Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Larry Huff. And for those of you who might have missed some of the earlier sessions, we are talking about biblical stories and how those biblical stories progress into later versions of those stories, particularly stories that developed around the first century AD, first century BC, first and second century AD, informed called Midrash, which were written by mainly by the rabbis, who were attempting to interpret and make contemporary the stories from the Bible. And then we're also looking at a couple of later versions of those stories as well. We started on Monday with stories about beginnings, the beginnings in Genesis. And we're looking mainly at Genesis stories for most of the week. On Friday, we will get to the end of Torah, to Deuteronomy, and we might just throw in some Solomon to boot, but we'll see how that progresses. Yesterday, we talked about how and why Midrash grew up, and I'm going to repeat some of that and go on a little bit further today. There was a desire to keep the story alive. So one of the first reasons why Midrash developed was to keep the story alive. One of the problems with things that get written down is they tend to ossify. They tend to turn to stone. And we used the illustration yesterday of when we listen to lessons on Sunday morning, we tend to say, "Oh, I've heard that lesson before," and we don't listen very well to those lessons. Maybe we'll listen more to the sermon, which is an attempt to interpret. Unfortunately, we don't listen very carefully to those lessons, and I think there are a whole bunch of reasons for that. One of the things is we're kind of used to it. Secondly, we've lost the biblical story as an oral form. And many of you may print your lessons in your bulletin, or you have an insert that's in your bulletin. And one of the strange things that's happened in the church is we have somebody up here reading the lesson, but instead of us listening to the lesson orally up here, even as it's being read, we've got our heads in our little Celebrate insert. The story's taking place here, and we're looking down here. What's happened now in our particular congregation is that we tend to use a screen for certain things, and the screen sort of takes the place of the bulletin. So parts of the liturgy are up there, the lessons are up there, and now what happens on Sunday morning when the lessons are read is that the lessons are read over here from the lectern pulpit, but everybody's looking over here at the wall where the lesson's being projected. Which suggests to me that we're not really communicating when we tell that story. And it was the attempt of Midrash to keep that story alive by constantly sort of reinventing, turning that story around a little bit, telling it in a slightly different way. Secondly, there was an attempt to focus on irregularities or gaps in the text, and the rabbis would say, "Well, there's something strange about that particular text. What's missing from that text? Or what's the context of that text that we really don't quite understand?" And they wrote a story to kind of fill those gaps. And we looked at the story of Cain and Abel yesterday, where the biblical text says, "And Cain said to Abel," and then they went out into the field and the murder took place. And what did Cain say to Abel? And the footnote in the Bible says, "Let us go out into the field," is a later addition to the text. A third reason, a third function of Midrash is to deal with discontinuity. Essentially, what that means is that the biblical text came into being over centuries. There was a period of oral development, which took centuries, and then there was a period of written development, which likewise took centuries. So you've got 5 or 6 centuries over which the biblical text comes into being, And during that time, ideas about who God is and the way God acts changes. Things like, what is the soul? What is this thing we call paradise or the life to come? Those ideas changed over time theologically during the history of the Bible. And because of that discontinuity, the rabbis attempted to deal with that discontinuity by telling stories which kind of explained some of those things out. We'll look at one of those stories on Friday, the story of the death of Moses. A fourth reason was to give a moral or didactic purpose to a story. We tell a story for a particular reason. What are you going to get out of the story? What is the moral of this particular story? And if it's not obvious in the biblical text, the rabbis will say, well, there's a moral to this story, and let me fill this out a little bit, and you'll see the moral a little bit more clearly. And one of the texts we look at this morning is going to attempt to do that, to explain that. That attempt is a typical homiletic method. We tend to do that in preaching today. So what is the story about? What's the sort of the moral of this story? And around the first century AD, there developed a character, it's going to be a different color, called a Darshan. And you'll notice that it comes, again, from the D-R-S-H root. So he's the person who interprets. And he was the equivalent of the developing Christian preacher in the Christian church, except that he was the preacher, kind of like the rabbi, but a rabbi slash preacher in the Jewish synagogue. And there develops a style of preaching in the synagogue that's eventually written down. And we've got versions of these early sermons preached by the Darshans in these synagogues. And they're full of Midrash. So a lot of the stories we have in Midrash come from these preachers who attempted to interpret frequently in a kind of didactic fashion. One of the interesting things that I discovered in the process of learning about Midrash is the way some of these early sermons were constructed. And one of the ways they did is they began with a story. The Darshan would begin with a story. He'd tell a story, get to the end of the story, and sort of shove the story aside. And you begin to scratch your head. Well, why in the world did he ever tell that story? Maybe you've had a pastor who's done that. And he goes somewhere else, goes a completely different direction, talks about the text, does some other things, and then at the very end of the sermon, he takes and pulls everything together. And you look back at that story and you say, aha! That's why he told that story. And after all this time, he told it for this purpose. I've done that on occasion. Because I think it's a rather interesting teaching method. Tell that old story, then let it flop out there. I'll come back to the story at the end of the sermon. Hopefully bring it together sometime. Maybe I don't. But an interesting way to preach. At the time of Jesus, there was already a kind of a formational lectionary. A lectionary is a series of lessons which are repeated throughout what we call the church year. And the Jewish folk have the equivalent of a church year. It's sort of the synagogue year. It's the Jewish year in which you have the great festivals of Judaism. And you have certain texts which are used at certain times during the year. That system of lectionary texts was already coming into being at the time of Jesus. So what these Darshans would do is they'd take these texts that kept repeating and build stories on them. Let's look at a particular illustration of that in the book of Luke, Luke chapter 4. One of the problems of getting older is you tend to have dry hands, and particularly on cold mornings, cold hands and dry hands don't turn pages very quickly. Chapter 4, verses 16 to 19. Luke 4, 16 to 19. And let's have somebody read that.
So he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and his custom was he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath and stood up to read. And he was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has appointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and the recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to claim the acceptable year of the Lord."
Okay, good. Jesus comes into the synagogue in Nazareth. He sits down. The head of the synagogue brings him the scroll of Isaiah. Back then, you don't have the whole canon in one book where you can just open up the whole Bible. You've got certain scrolls for certain books. And he's handed the scroll of Isaiah. Why is he handed the scroll of Isaiah? Did he go up to the man who's the head of the synagogue and say, "Hey, I want to do Isaiah today. Bring out Isaiah." No. The man who is the head of the synagogue brings out the scroll of Isaiah. Why? Well, we're not quite sure. But there's a possibility that he brought out Isaiah because either they've been reading the Bible in chorus, which means we've been reading up through Isaiah, and we've now gotten to Isaiah, or Isaiah is the appointed text for this day. So it's already a lectionary issue, and Jesus picks up where the lectionary wants him to pick up and reads this particular text. And of course, this text in some way refers to Jesus himself. So we've got the idea already of preacher here. And Jesus was a kind of a preacher. After all, he was a rabbi. I could safely say, I think, that my interest in storytelling professionally grew out originally of my interest in preaching. I was looking for a way to engage people's interest. So my interest in storytelling goes way back to the beginning of my ministry. Now, my interest in biblical storytelling goes back to an organization called the Network of Biblical Storytellers, which was founded at United Seminary in Dayton, Ohio, by a man by the name of Tom Boomershine and one of his friends. And the intent of the Network of Biblical Storytellers was to help people, not just pastors, but lay folk as well, to memorize biblical stories so that they could stand up in front of you and not read the story, and you're reading the story, but actually tell the story so that it could be an oral event. So I started with a Network of Biblical Stories and worked with them for a couple of years, learning from them. My interest in post-biblical storytelling, or midrash, goes a slightly different direction. About midway through my time as a campus pastor at Wittenberg, I discovered that my Hebrew had kind of atrophied. If you don't use a language, it tends to fade away out of your memory bank. And Hebrew is a totally different alphabet, and it's a very different kind of language. And I thought to myself, if I'm going to use Hebrew, and here I am in a college, and I probably should, let me renew it. So I went back to seminary, to United Seminary in Dayton, and started my Hebrew all over again. And when I took the basic courses, I transferred into an upper-level course with a gentleman who was himself Jewish and taught Hebrew in a marvelous way. And among the things that he taught, in addition to biblical translation, is he got me translating Hebrew poetry and then translating Midrash. Because of the problems of change in language over time, Hebrew had actually become almost a kind of a dead language. The language of Jesus' day was Aramaic, and it's different than Hebrew. So one of the jobs of the Darshan is to read the text in Hebrew, but then to kind of translate it and retell it in Aramaic. one of the great scholars in the late 19th century took a number of these midrashim, which were in Aramaic, and translated them back into Hebrew. So what I did was I translated them out of Hebrew into English. And to do that, I did a sabbatical. I decided to do a sabbatical in Jerusalem. And there are two ways to kind of renew a language. One is to use the language in speech. And Hebrew is very peculiar in that it's about the only language I know in which that contemporary language is practically identical to the ancient language. So contemporary Hebrew is basically the same as biblical Hebrew. That's intentional, because the folk who settled Hebrew said, we need a language to pull us together. We Jewish folk live all over the world. We've got 100 different languages we use. What language can we have that will pull us together? And they said, well, Hebrew, that's our ancestral language. So they took Hebrew and basically built a contemporary language using biblical Hebrew. So I went to Jerusalem, and I went to what's called an ulpan. And an ulpan is a place where you learn contemporary Hebrew. So I went for 3 months to an ulpan so I could try to speak it, thinking, if I can speak it, then maybe I can remember it in its written form as well. And then I took a tutorial from the dean of Hebrew Union College in Jerusalem, who had me translating Midrash, both from Hebrew and then later from Rabbinic Hebrew, which is slightly different. So then I developed this interest in Midrash. The next step was, having done this in Jerusalem, I thought, how can I share this with students? These stories are really interesting. Plus, this place is interesting. And so I came up with the idea. Number one is, I'd like to share this with students. Share two things. Number one is the geography of Israel. If you're going to understand the story, you got to feel a story. If you're going to tell stories about Paul Bunyan, you got to learn something about the North Woods and what it's like to chop down trees. If you're going to tell stories about the biblical land and an arid biblical land, either you've got to live out in the desert of Phoenix, Arizona, or you've got to go to Israel and feel a little bit of what it's like to live in a really arid land and what wilderness is like. And wilderness is different than desert, incidentally. So the idea was, I wanted to take a group of students to Israel to experience the land and see how the geography influenced the story, and then teach them a little bit about the Midrash that develops out of the story. So a professor at Wittenberg, Barbara Kaiser, Old Testament professor, and I put together a course. And what we would do is we'd go to Israel for about 2 to 3 weeks. And the student's task was to learn a biblical story associated with a particular location. They would either memorize the story out of the Bible, or they could rewrite it slightly for their own use. And then we would tell that story in a location associated with it. Then I would tell the Midrashic version of that story and a later version of that story. The creation stories, for example, since we don't exactly have Eden, I would tell either on the edge of the Dead Sea or out on the sand of the Mediterranean Sea. There's lots of water in that story, so that's a good place to do it. The Abrahamic stories I told in Beersheba. The Solomonic stories I told in Jerusalem, and obviously we told the Passion stories in Jerusalem as well. I first told the Solomon stories on top of the Temple Mount area, which is actually controlled by Arab folk today. There's the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. And the first year I told the Solomon stories up there. We started doing that my second year when one of the Arabic guards said, you can't do that up here, folks. That moved us along. So we went up farther on Mount of Olives. And then looking back on Temple Mount, we told those stories. So that's kind of how my interest in Midrash was shaped and developed. Today I'm going to focus on a couple of stories that grow out of that question of irregularities or gaps in the story. And we're going to move on in Genesis to the Abrahamic stories. So let's look at Genesis chapter 11. Genesis 11, 31. And we're going to go to about 12:5. Anybody want to read that?
Terah took his son Abram, and his grandson Lot, son of Aram, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abraham's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abraham went as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Abram took his wife Sarai and his brother's son Lot and all the possessions that they had gathered and the persons whom they had acquired in Haran, and they set forth to go to the land of Canaan. When they came to the land, I guess that's as far as you want to
go. Yeah, well, we can just stop there. There's a bit of a gap in that story. What's the gap in the text that you just heard? Anybody know what the gap is? We wouldn't necessarily think of this as a gap because we've heard that story so often, but there's a gap.
Is it why they moved?
Why they moved, right. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, how old do you think Abraham is? His dad brings him.
Dad is 200. Okay.
When he dies.
Yeah.
Abraham would be, well, we know when Isaac was born, he was 100. Mm-hmm. So.
And at this point where he finally moves and is told to leave, he's 75. What about this in-between gap? How old was the kid when he came to Haran? And what happened to him? How does Abraham become a monotheist? What's his background? It's a little bit like the story of Jesus. We get this marvelous birth narrative. And all of a sudden he's 12 years old. And then all of a sudden he's 30 years old. Well, what in the world happened in between? The rabbis ask exactly that question. Here you got this kid, Abraham, who's brought, well, we don't know what age he was, but he's brought to Haran by his dad, and then all of a sudden he's 75 years old. What in the world happened in the meantime? So, it's a gap. And so stories build up around that gap. This is one of those stories. While Abraham was still a boy, he lived with his father Terah in a cave. Now, Terah kept his son in a cave hidden from the cruel King Nimrod, who had heard from the Magi that a child by the name of Abraham would eventually become the father of a great race. So, for many years, the young Abraham did not see the light of day. When he first saw the sun, he fell down on his knees and worshiped. This light can only come from the one who rules the world. He watched the sun going across the sky. But at night, the sun disappeared and was replaced by the moon. Now, the moon was not as large, but Abraham bent low before the moon because it had replaced the sun, and besides, all those stars gathered around to give light to the moon. Surely this is the Lord of all the worlds, Abraham thought to himself. But then, too, the moon disappeared, only to be replaced by the sun the next morning. What a strange thing that these two great lights should come and replace each other, crossing the sky each day. Someone must be behind their journey, someone invisible, someone more mighty than them, a lordly and powerful ruler whom no one can see, but no one can surpass. And so it was that Abraham came to know God. But Abraham kept these thoughts to himself, for his father would not have approved. As a child, how did you come to know God? What were your earliest perceptions of God? What was God like? And how did you come to know that? Anybody?
The God of my childhood looked an awful lot like my dad.
Yeah.
Even with long glasses.
Yeah. We learn about God in no small part from our parents. Yeah.
Jesus loves me, this I know, the song. You
know? Yeah, sure.
And I sat in the same pew in a Dave Lutheran church in Tyler, Minnesota, and we always sat in the same pew, and comfortable pew, beautiful church, and I just said, oh, I'm safe here. Mm-hmm. And I go back there frequently. Last year when I was sitting, and my sister always sits in another pew, and I said, no, I want to sit in our pew. So I got there early enough so nobody was sitting in our pew. You know how small churches are.
We founded our local congregation in Vermilion, Ohio. My parents were one of the founding members of the congregation. And we met in the Vermilion on the Lake Clubhouse, which was a great big log structure overlooking Lake Erie. And we would come in on Sunday morning and have to clean off the tabletops from the parties the night before and move them off to the side. And then we put chairs in place. We'd roll out this portable altar and this portable pulpit. We'd put up the lid on the grand piano and the bandstand, but we'd have to clean that off from all the glass stains also. And then we would divide the whole room up with these huge curtains, which we divided the place up because it was too large for us. And the lake would roll outside, or the wind would blow outside, and we worshiped together in a very kind of informal way. My mother was a choir director, and most of my earliest experiences are of music and how music touches you and builds your faith. Childhood memories, childhood experiences, how important they are to molding one's faith. Here's a little story about Abraham and good old King Nimrod. Once Abraham was brought before King Nimrod. It was the king's hope that he could convince Abraham to worship him and his gods. "Let us worship fire," said King Nimrod to Abraham. "It's clear that fire is mightier than any other substance." "If so," Abraham responded, "then we really should serve the water, because a water can extinguish the fire." "Ah, then let us bow down to the water," said the king. "But the clouds are stronger, because the clouds can carry the water." "You're right," said the king. "Maybe we should worship the clouds." "And yet," said Abraham, the winds disperse the clouds, so they must be stronger than the clouds." "I agree," said the king. "Let us worship the wind." No, a human being is stronger than wind, because a human being can take the wind and harness it. And so the debate continued, because Abraham would serve God alone. Something known as natural theology. And natural theology is really interesting, but it has its limitations. One of the interesting... We experience it here in Holden. You and I experience it every day in Holden. How do we discover God? We look up at the mountains, and we see the majesty of the mountains. We see the river rolling through here, and we say, look what God has given us, and we discover God in the majesty of nature around us. One of the ways we discover God is what's through natural theology. There's nothing wrong with natural theology. Basically, what you heard is a story about natural theology right there. Nimrod basically says, look at the wind, look at the fire, look at the water, look how strong they are. Maybe we should worship these things. That might seem a little bit superficial, but there's something behind that. And that is that God is in the rain, God is in the water, God is in the fire, God is in the mountains. And that's good. Much of the poetry that comes out of Holden is built around that. But there are some limitations to that. Among those limitations are we human beings and our experience as human beings, which isn't always the same as the experiences of nature. How important relationship is to our discovery of how God works within us and around us. That's not to negate the glory of nature, the beauty of nature, the gift of nature, and our responsibility to nature. We looked at that creation story on Monday, but really didn't get into it, unfortunately. But there's a problem with natural theology, and it can lead us only so far, I think. Let's look at a midrash on the youth of Abraham. Abraham's father owned a shop that sold idols. Terach would make them out of clay and then place them on a shelf to sell. One day, when Abraham was a little bit older, Terach went off on a trip and he left his son in charge of his shop. Before long, a man came into the shop and said, my wife has sent me to buy a god who can watch over us, but will not require too many sacrifices. And Abraham nodded his head and said, and how old are you? And the man said, well, I'm 60. I'm 60 years old. You're 60 years old, Abraham laughed. Then why would you wish to buy a god that my father made only yesterday? And the man left ashamed. The next day, a woman entered the shop carrying a bowl of flour. Take this flour, please, and give it to one of the gods. What nonsense is this? Abraham cried. Can a clay god eat anything? And he took a stick and he smashed all of the clay gods in his father's shop, all but one. He used his head. He left the largest one standing and put the stick in the hand of the largest of the idols. When Terach returned home, he was full of rage. What's the meaning of this? Don't be angry, Dad. A woman came into the shop with a bowl of grain and wanted me to give it to one of the idols, but the idols began arguing with each other and they were fighting with one another, and the largest of them took a stick and destroyed all the rest. No sooner had Terach heard the story than he bellowed, do you take me for a fool? How could statues, which I have created with my own hands, be hungry or argue with each other? Exactly, Father. You yourself have said it. Your idols have eyes that do not see, they have ears that do not hear, They have hands which do not touch and feet which do not walk. They are only lumps of lifeless clay. How can anyone worship them?" Terach did not reply. Abraham left the shop, and from that moment on, he made no secret of his knowledge of the one true God.
Where do you get all these?
Oh, there are a number of different sources, a number of different books, different collections. And some of them are more popular, some are more scholarly than others. One of the problems, these are marvelous stories. One of the problems, however, with stories like this is what we tend to do is say, well, that's a fun story. But people then were really very superstitious. You know, who would believe in a clay god? Anyway, we're much more sophisticated than that. We don't believe in idols and gods and things like that. We don't have that problem anymore. So we think of that as a cute story. But we don't necessarily think of it as a story that relates to us. And so I want to give you a later version of that story in a slightly different form. But to do that first, I want us to look at Matthew chapter 6. Familiar passage, but a very important passage. Matthew chapter 6, verses 25 to 33. And anybody can read that.
"Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more important than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to this life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the lilies of the field grow? They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you? O you of little faith. So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well."
Thank you. On Monday, my wife went to Judy's session. I wasn't able to get there. And she said, you know, Judy told us a creation story. And I didn't know that Judy was going to do that. We did not plot this in advance. But there's a lot of serendipity that takes place at Holden. And so Gundel brought me the version that Judy used in her class from Tales of the Pointless People by Dan Erlander. And Dan begins his collection on the pointless people with a retelling of a story by Ann Herbert. And I'll give you the essence of that story real quick, because I want to give you another version of that from Dan's book. And the main thrust of the first story is that God creates the Garden of Eden as a place of joy and laughter, and a place to play and to frolic and to be loving, creative creatures together. And so it continues until one day the snake comes along. And the snake says, well, you really seem to be enjoying frolicking and playing and having a good time, but you're missing something. You know, you'd really enjoy playing much better if you collected points. Every time that you play something, you see who did the best at that, and then you give them points. And then when you play the next game, you have points for that, and you eventually add up those points, and you see who's best at playing, who's best at frolicking. And so people started doing that. They would run a race, and see who was the best at running, and you get 5 points. And they would have hurdles, and they would see who won at that, and they would have 10 points. And soon they had some people who had 25 points, and some people who only had 2 points. And eventually they had wonderful scores of people who had 100 points and even 500 points. And they were obviously the best at playing. It's a story about the fall and the way that we begin to set up hierarchies and people who are more important than other people. Dan Erlander takes that basic story and then sort of plays it out about human life and human experience as we develop people who are good at things and people who are not good at things and people who have value because they're good at things or they rule well or they're well-educated or they're great athletes. And then tells the story of the redemption as Jesus coming to say, you don't have to have points. We can all return to the play in life, the frolic in life, where we experience the joy of simply being human beings together. You're not better than I am. I'm not better than you are. But we share in the abundance which God wishes for all people. So there's this story back and forth in the Bible of the snake returning periodically to suggest, well, you really got to put some points to this. For example, if you're going to be educated, if you're going to go to a liberal arts college, you're going to have to collect some points because you're not going to graduate from your liberal arts college, even if it's a Lutheran liberal arts college, unless you've got so many points. And then God has to constantly be sort of reinvigorating. The wind of Pentecost has to flow through things again. This is a little story by Dan Erlander called The Big Box and The Little Box. Some of you may know it. Incidentally, I think this is over in the bookstore. Dan Erlander is a pastor. Some of you may know him because he comes frequently up here to Holden, sort of a second home for Dan Erlander. He was a campus pastor at Pacific Lutheran as well as serving other places. And he had a marvelous, marvelous sense of humor. Dan is a little bit older than I. And when I was a young campus pastor, I really looked up to Dan because he had this great sense of humor, which I didn't have at the time.
You don't have to have points.
I don't have to have points. After thinking and thinking, the snake came up with an ingenious idea. He brought a gift to the pointless people. And Dan's description of Christianity is as the pointless people. A gift wrapped in gold, paper, and silver ribbon. The pointless people gathered around the gift, gazing at the beautiful packaging. They stared at it until somebody said, "Oh, let's open it." They took off the gold wrap, opened the package, and pulled out 2 strange items. A large box about the size of a big suitcase, and a smaller box about the size of a bar of soap. And here's Dan's illustration. And it's a flat screen TV and a remote. Confused at first, the people soon discovered that by pushing the on button on the smaller box, a picture would appear on the larger box. They pushed the on button and stared at the picture. They stared and stared and stared. Soon they were mesmerized. They quickly gave up frolicking in order to have more time to stare at the box. Smiling, the snake said, "I have their attention, and now I will give them commercials." And it was so. Here's what commercials did. They displayed beautiful human bodies tied to a subtle message, "You ought to look like this." On the box, women looked eternally young, wrinkle-free, with perfectly shaped bodies, thick hair blowing in the wind, big eyes, and sensuous full lips. Men had firm, muscular bodies, dark eyes, thick, wavy hair, and looks on their faces of detachment and self-sufficiency. Men were allowed to get a little older as long as they didn't lose their hair and had only slight graying at the temples. In between the commercials, the box showed pictures of people murdering each other. The pointless people stared at the box so long that they accepted its reality. However, when they left the box long enough to glance into their mirrors, they realized that they didn't look like the people in the commercials. They scored themselves very low. Then, in anxiety, they rushed to stores to buy things that would make them look like the people in the box. When this did not work, they began to buy all the products that the people either stood on, sat on, leaned on, wore, drove, ate, or drank on the box. This made the people at least feel more beautiful. Soon they began giving themselves points for buying what they saw on the box. Nobody frolicked anymore because they were too busy buying things and investing to secure the future. Anxiety filled the land. Of course, God was wroth, very wroth, and thought about wiping out the box with one bolt of lightning. Instead, God again sent the Spirit to the land. The Spirit came as a gentle breeze. People were so attracted to the breeze that they pushed the mute button on the books. Now there was silence, and a still small voice said, "Push the off button." Lo, the pointless people obeyed. They actually pushed the off button. In the silence and the emptiness, they recognized the voice as the one who had whispered many years ago, "You don't need points." The voice said, "I validated you on the cross in my suffering for you, in my resurrection, in all my promises. I called you by name. You are beautiful just as you are. Why are you so anxious about your life, what you shall eat and what you shall drink? And what you shall wear, how you look, your image. Your heavenly Father knows all your needs. Seek first God's banquet with all its frolicking and visions of justice and peace, and all these things shall be yours as well." The pointless people dropped the little box, turned their back to the large box, and held hands for the first time in months and began to dance. Yes, they began to dance. The snake was very discouraged. He slithered away lamenting, "This proves that humans can never be trusted to do what is wrong." However, several weeks later, the snake came up with a new idea. Computers. I'll use computers. So I think the story of Abraham and the idols is not so old-fashioned as we might think, because we have our own gods. I'd like to move on from the childhood of Abraham to one of the great stories of Abraham. And this is one of the first stories I ever learned in the biblical storytelling process. And I first found it in a book called To Tell of Gideon by John Harrell. It's an old book, and it had a little plastic floppy record in it. And it had John Harrell telling this story to a congregation. This is called An Isaac Laugh. And Isaac laughed. Now, this is the story of a theophany, one of those mystifying experiences in which God reveals God's self to us. One day when Abraham was about 100 years old, in the heat of the day, he and his wife Sarah were sitting just inside the flap of the tent. And Abraham looked out and saw strangers coming in the distance. And he got up and he went out to them and bent low in Bedouin fashion. And he said, "May it please you, come and rest under my tree, and I will bring you water to bathe your feet, and I will prepare something for you to eat." And the stranger said, "Be it as you say." And so Abraham went into the tent and said to Sarah, "Take three measures of grain and baked bread." And he went out into the field and selected a tender calf and took it to a steward who said, "Prepare it for us to eat." And then Abraham himself took some milk and curds and made a special dish himself. And when all was prepared, he took it to the tree and presented it to the strangers and served them himself. When they were finished eating, one of the strangers said, "Where is your wife, Sarah?" "She is in the tent." "At this time, in 1 year, your wife will give birth to a child." Now Sarah was sitting in the tent, and she heard this, and she thought to herself, "I'm too old to have a child. And besides, Abraham is too old for that kind of thing." And she laughed. But the stranger said, "Why did your wife laugh? Is anything too hard?" And Sarah thought to herself, "Who are these men that they know what I am thinking? And what do they mean by the Lord?" And she yelled out, "I did not laugh." "Oh, but you did." And just as the stranger said, in 1 year's time, Sarah gave birth to a son, and she named him Isaac, which means "he laughs." We're going to have a grand total of 4 minutes for discussion.
Do you have a list of some of these books?
I'm not even sure this one's in print anymore. It's called To Tell of Gideon. It's a really ancient book. My copy is falling apart. Look for if you're going to a library or to a bookstore, look for collections of Jewish legends and stories. That's one of the best places to look. We'll be telling a story tomorrow about an old woman and the wisdom of Solomon. It may be a touch of Midrash, but it's really more legended story. And I just got out of it a collection of Jewish folk stories. There are other collections, but they're rather scholarly.
What was this one you just said?
Jewish legends and stories.
Even if we find these books, you won't be telling the stories.
Yeah. Oh, but as you read them, you yourself move into that world. Any other thoughts or comments on any of the stories particularly interested you? Thank you for your time and your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.